danger is stealing in as relapse sums above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day.
Hello and welcome to episode 87 of the Thinking Poker Podcast in Somerville, Massachusetts, but a different part of Somerville now. I'm Nate Mavis, and with me is Andrew Brokus. And are you back in Pittsburgh?
No, I no longer live in Pittsburgh. I am currently coming to you from Catonsville, Maryland, my girlfriend's mother's house specifically. We are likely to be moving to San Francisco, but that won't be for a few months, so we're just kind of bumming around until September.
Fantastic. So doing the poker nomad thing for a while.
Yeah, probably emphasis on the nomad this time around.
It's poker financed nomad. Yeah. I mean, on your end, your girlfriend makes money in other ways, I'm sure. So, yeah. Good. So your trip to Las Vegas treated you well?
Yeah, it was, financially, not my most spectacular trip ever, but definitely great to hang out with you, to meet the listeners at the meetup, to get to run into some old friends, meet some new people. I think we had a good time the day that we went to, or I had a good time, I assume you did as well, the day that we went to Red Rock and got to meet up with Ed Miller, and then doing the live show with Carlos. Have you listened to the live show with Leo yet?
No, I haven't. I'm waiting for the next day I walk to work so that I can give it my good attention.
I'll be curious to hear your feedback on that. But Leo and I talked some about our World Series, but my assumption is that listeners will be curious to hear. I mean, I already know, but how your World Series went and especially how it ended.
Yeah, it was good. The trip was great. It was like yours, it was a social success. The day at Red Rock was excellent. Breyer was also there, who I think a lot of listeners will know as a frequent, very good commenter on your blog. And hung out with him. That was a great time. And the whole trip was good. I didn't cash in the main event, but the side games were good and a lot of fun to play in. We thought that for the strategy segment this week, I would talk about my bust out hand. It's not just a sad story. I think it's strategically interesting. I've talked a little bit on the show before about how I'm have more experience in single raised pots than I do in three bet pots, and how sometimes I try to play them. And this year, one of my goals was to get out of my comfort zone a little bit, just because you're giving up a lot if you're reluctant to three bet as much as is proper. I did bust out in a three bet pot, and although I'm happy with my decisions, it was definitely some different muscles that I was working, and so it was sort of the new Nate playing a pot, and I thought I thought it'd be fun to talk about. So should we get into that? Should we tell them who's bringing us the strategy segment before we talk?
Yes,
about
Yes, I'm glad you reminded me about that because I forgot to do this last week. So Tournament Poker Edge, as always, our strategy sponsor, and in particular, I want to call your attention to a new series going up on Tournament Poker Edge right now that features podcast stalwart Carlos Welch, or Loxy as he's known on the TPE forums. He's doing a video with Cody Custer. This is actually from a tournament that he played from my apartment, although I was sleeping for most of the time that he played it, so there was no danger of my ghosting him there, quite the opposite. If anything, I was occasionally like wandering by to go to the bathroom and get a drink of water and be like, oh, hey, you're still in the tournament? So he was playing this tournament, ended up final tabling for my apartment, and he has Cody Custer, one of the full-time instructors at TPE, going over the hand history with him. So the two of them will be talking some tournament poker strategy. And I think what a lot of people have told us, which I think is true, that Carlos fills kind of is shoes that a lot of our listeners can get into, like ask questions that are on a lot of our listeners' minds. So hopefully he's going to have that effect in this hand history review as well, if maybe there are things that would be obvious to Cody but not to some of the viewers of the video. Probably having Carlos's perspective in there will be pretty helpful, so I definitely encourage people to go check out that new series as well as all the other great stuff at tournamentpokeredge.com.
Absolutely. It's a bit of a shame. Carlos is improving very rapidly, and soon enough, it'll be very hard for listeners to get in his shoes. So, yeah. So here's the hand, and this takes place at the beginning of day three on the main event. And
Brag.
It's not a brag. Yeah, it just means I spent longer making $0. Spoiler alert. I had just doubled through somebody maybe half an orbit before. Well, no, a full orbit before, almost exactly, with ace-six suited against ace-king. And I mentioned that largely so that I'm not telling as much of a bad beat story, just because I was only there because I'd ran a worse hand through a better one. What's relevant is that we're maybe four orbits into the day. No, three orbits into the day. So that's plenty of time to get a sense of what's going on. I mean, from a statistical standpoint, 25 hands is nothing. But my main opponent in this hand had played a lot of pots. He'd maybe gotten outplayed. He'd been put in tough spots. He'd lost pots. He'd gotten frustrated. I felt like I knew this guy really well. I didn't know who he was until I saw him on my table draw. And I'd only played, unless I've played with him before and forgotten about it, those are the only 25 hands in my life I'd played with him. But I had a good physical read on him. He was doing things different ways with different kinds of hands. And I just had a very good sense of who this was. This is a weekend warrior type. This is probably the best player in his home game. Maybe he lives close to Foxwoods or that card room in West Virginia or someplace like that. And he can beat the 1-2 or 2-5 game on the weekends. He probably has a little bit of a narrow view of what he ought to be doing at the poker table, but he's one of these guys who plays pretty well, who probably wins a tournament every now and then, but is probably not playing super balanced, is probably not that creative, and probably thinks he deserves to win with his best starting hands. One of these types. I'm not putting this in the best way, but I think I've got a psychological sense of where this guy is. So he started the day with about 120,000, and he was down to about 80,000 when the hand starts. And he's two to the right of the button, and he opens for 3,600 at 800, 1,600 with a 200 ante. Now, right away, we should think about what his range is for that play. I think he's not as loose as the most aggressive openers will be there, partly because he's got the shorter stack, me to his left, partly because he has a player who I think we all suspect of being strong in the blinds. There's also maybe a slightly looser player in the big blind, and he doesn't seem to be the sort who reacts to a looser player by trying to play a lot of pots with him. Like, he's probably the sort to say, I can't steal his blind, not to say, oh, this loose guy's in the blind, I should steal with like queen four suited so that I can see a lot of flops with this guy and outplay him.
Yeah, he's like, I can't play a junk hand against this guy. He's never folds.
Yeah, right. So that's what I think. I think he's opening actually probably a pretty good range. I think he's not going crazy, but I think he's not going to be afraid to open ace nine suited or something like that. Or maybe he is. I think that's, you know, a borderline-ish hand. So he opens for 3,600. I'm on the button with two nines and 40K. And here right away, there's a decision. I think some people would just call here. I think past versions of myself would just call here. I think just calling here is bad. I think I should three bet. I think two nines is great. And I'll get into tough spots sometimes, but I want to be three betting. I'd rather play a heads up pot than a three handed pot. Getting a fold is excellent. Playing a pot in position is fine. And I think there's no good alternative to three betting here. What do you think?
In old Nate's defense, I'll say that old Andrew would also probably flat here. But I think you're right that that's... And part of it is that the player that you describe, the old version of the player you describe, might have a somewhat tighter range 2 or 3 years ago than he does now. So it may be that these old versions of ourselves are not playing quite as badly. Nonetheless, like, I do think that if you just look at it as, well, I don't really want to take a coin flip in this tournament, and like, obviously you're not three betting with the intention of folding. when you put it in, you're not going to be a huge favorite against his range for getting it in if you're a favorite at all. But I think that you really don't want to undervalue the fold equity that you get from three betting, both the fold equity from making this guy fold a hand like Queen Jack offsuit, which is fantastic when you hold pocket nines, and also the fold equity that comes from not letting the big blind see a cheap flop. And that in one sense, there's not a lot of value in making the big blind fold a hand like 7-4 suited or the sort of thing that might just overcall, getting a great price if you call on the button, but you know, it's not going to continue to a 3-bet. But there's a lot of hands. Hey, there's a lot of hands that do have better equity against nines, like a ace-six offsuit or something that he might overcall from the big blind. But there is also value in making him fold 7-4 suited. I mean, he's going to make a correct call with that hand if you flat with nines. So denying him the opportunity to do that really is worth something. And when you have a stack as short as the one that you have, locking up, even if it only happens 15% of the time, locking up a 6,000-7,000 chip pot by three betting and getting a fold is pretty fantastic when you only have 40,000 chips. And I think that having to put your stack in when you're only going to be about a 50-50 against his getting an in range, you know, that's not like that's the guaranteed outcome here. That's kind of the it's a common worst case scenario, but that's like the worst thing that can happen is that you end up getting it in 50-50. And the fact that you are going to win a decent sized pot a good amount of the time without showdown, I think, is definitely something worth valuing and worth being willing to take a flip for your tournament life to get that.
Yeah, absolutely. So I would pick up 8K if this got through. And because of that, there's actually a case to be made just for jamming, especially against a slightly looser opponent. I would rather maintain the ability to 3-bet with a somewhat wider range, and I don't think that these opponents are really going to exploit anything I give up by 3-betting smaller instead of jamming, but it's wonderful when I take this down before the flop. So that's, yeah. Good. So I make it 8,600. So my stack is 40K. The open was to 3,600. What do you think of the size?
I think it's good. I mean, I think that it's a little bigger than it would need to be against a player who is going to insist on like 4-betting or folding at a position, which is, I think, what a lot of the kind of like tourney tournament specialists, like, I think that's kind of what they're going to do. And against them, you know, maybe a smaller size is enough to the point because they're not ever going to flat a 4-bet. But this sounds like a player who might. And so I think making it a touch bigger so that he doesn't just decide to peel you with the Queen Jack offsuit or something is pretty good for you.
Yeah, I should say, and I should have mentioned this earlier, that I've already seen him just call a 3-bet out of position. So that's important. And yeah, by the way, seeing one of these like cranky middle-aged American guys like get owned out of position by Martin Stasko, it's fun. It's very theatrical. So that's good. So I make it 8,600. The blinds fold. He thinks and he calls. I don't think he's Hollywooding with a really good hand. I think he might have made a frustration call that he shouldn't have made, but in this case, the physical read that I got at the time, I remember thinking, okay, this is near the bottom of his like calling range. He's not reaching into his folding range. He's not reaching into his bluff 4-betting range. But neither is he at the top. He's like, ah, screw it, I call. You know, I mean, that doesn't mean he's got something great. It could be like ace jack is the sort of hand he might have. A pocket pair is the sort of hand he might have. It's possible he could have a hand like ace king that he's feeling a little stubborn with and doesn't want to commit a lot with, even though he should really just jam that hand against me. But you know, like ace queen, I don't think he's getting tricky with king's raises or anything like that. I think he doesn't want to fold, and I think he's not folding.
Yeah, obviously I wasn't there, but based on what you've told me about this guy, I think I do have some sense of the kind of player we're dealing with, and I think I can envision the range you're talking about. It sounds right to me.
Yeah, good. So he calls, and that means that there's, you know, 21K or so go in the pot going to the flop, which is 10-5-4 rainbow, and he checks. Here, I think I don't really have an option other than betting. You can construct opponents against which I should do other things, but against this opponent, I think I should bet. I also don't think that I should jam, even though I have a pot-sized bet left. I can effectively price out some of the hands I want to price out, and I would like to be able to make this bet with a hand like Ace-Jack. So I should, or I mean, maybe sometimes I'm getting goofy and picking on weakness, and maybe I have Queen 3 suited sometimes, and I would like to bet this flop without jamming it with those hands. So I bet 7,600. So smaller than my pre-flop 3 bet, but I think this is enough to get the job done.
Yeah, with the effective stack being as small as it is, I think you don't need to bet large here at all. This is also not a board where your opponent's continuing range is going to be terribly size sensitive. Like, it's not like there's a lot of draws that he might get priced into if you bet a really small amount where, you know, he could peel you with a gut shot and then he would have to fold to a bigger bet or something. I think on this board, he's mostly just either going to check shove or check fold. And so you just need to bet an amount, you know, that's going to induce that from him, and that's what you want to do with your whole range. And you'll have a bet folding range and a bet calling range here, and this is clearly a hand that belongs in your bet calling range. The common misconception that I think a lot of people have with spots like this, people say, well, isn't it better to be the one putting my opponent to a decision rather than the one who has to call a shove myself? And I think that, you know, A, you are putting your opponent decision by making a smaller bet. The idea is that you do want to put him to a decision, but you want to risk the smallest amount of chips that you can, because, as you say, that enables you to make this same play with other types of hands. And it means that when your opponent sees this bet, he can think to himself, oh, this guy might just be betting with Ace-Jack or Queen-Jack suited or something. Whereas if you make a big shove, he can't really say to himself, well, maybe this guy's just shipping it here with Queen-Jack suited. I mean, he could think that, but it's a little harder for him to justify that. And this is not a case really where you want fold equity. So, you know, there are times when you want to shove to maximize your fold equity, or so that your opponent can't try to like check shove on you thinking he has fold equity. This is not one of those cases. You know, there no better hand is going to fold, so you're not really trying to make your opponent fold here. You would like to induce a shove from hands worse than nines.
That's right. I mean, it's the main event. People have done sillier things than fold a 10 here, but I'm not counting on that happening, especially not with somebody in this mood. I do think that you're right that not a lot of draws are going to peel. I think if I bet much smaller, then a hand like naked overcards could come along for one bet, especially. Yeah. But for the most part, I think you've got it right there. So I bet 7,600, and he thinks for a while and he jams. You know, like, he just puts 10 orange chips into the center, which is enough to put me in. In some sense, this is a slightly more interesting decision if I don't pick up a physical read at this point. So now, while I agree that in the abstract, nines is just a bet call here, thinking costs nothing, right? And it is a live tournament, and some people are going to now never jam with worse hands than nines, right? And so you should think about it. certainly 3 years ago, I you know, this is a hand you could consider folding. I mean, sometimes people just aren't going with it unless they can beat nines. That said, you know, especially with a read like the one I have, there's really going to it would take a special sort of evidence for me to fold this hand. One bit of just sort of combinatorial analysis to do is that, like, if he can get to the flop with a lot of tens, that means he can get to the flop with a lot of whiffs also. Like, if he has jack 10, he probably has queen jack and king queen and all those things also. And if he has queen 10, maybe he has jack 9, maybe he has queen 9, maybe he has queen jack. Yeah, so if he's the sort to jam a 10, and if I have to worry about a 10, then I also have to be very sure he's never jamming his whiffs before I can fold this hand. So there's that. And then it's hard to beat nines on a 10-5-4 board. So, like, hey, nines is a good hand. As it happened, things got easier because this is somebody who behaved differently with different kinds of bets, and he looked very similar to how he looked when he bet folded. And it looked like he was making a thin, like, value bet. And he looked different to how he looked in other cases when he didn't show his hand and one time when he had a value hand. So, you know, given the overall psychological profile of the situation, given my overall read on the player, given the math of the situation, given that nines are off awesome, then you get this tell and he looks like he looked when he was thin value betting, or otherwise uncomfortable about his hand, he ended up folding, this is really an unfoldable hand. Any of that you disagree with?
No, the one thing I'll just clarify with regard to the it doesn't cost anything to think is that really, I know that you know this, that's thinking that you want to do before you make your bet.
Yes.
You don't want to bet and then be like, oh, he shoved on me. Maybe I should think about whether I'm going to call a shove. So I do think that it doesn't hurt to look, you know, to stare. So you can make your bet. You can say, I'm betting with the intention of calling a shove unless some new information in the form of like a strong physical tail comes to light. Then you make your bet. Then he shoves. And then you look at him, or you look at him as he shoves. And I suppose if you were to pick up, I would need a pretty strong read to let go of this. But if you did pick up, it's something that made you pretty confident, he felt very strong, I could see folding it. But I think that really the default here ought to be to bet call, as it sounds like it was for you. And folding would need to be something that you picked up on some exploitable read that you felt like you had a good bit of confidence stacked on that.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. But there are also some funny, like, disjunctive situations you get into when, when the best line is probably to bet call, but maybe you don't know which of four kinds of opponent you're up against, and the way that he moves his chip in will help you distinguish among them. There are cases other than this when you might plan to bet call, then change your plan. It's a bit like more common for you and more common these days for me situation is like planning to two or three barrel in a cash game, where it's like, okay, here's the board, here's the situation, this is a great spot to start pounding on this pot, right? And then he calls the first bet and he's really happy about it, but then you decide to maybe ease off a little bit. It's like that where you have your plan, you should probably stick to it, but not so infrequently you're going to see something that suggests otherwise. Anyway, I called, he had sixes, and he made a six. So good for him. And he won. One thing that I didn't tweet, but that was very funny, is I did stay alive long enough to see something funny happen at the table. I had Anton Makayevsky, who's a final tablist from 2011, and next to him was Fatima DeMello, I think. A Poker Stars pro, possibly a field hockey player from back in the day. Anyway, and they were speaking to each other, and they received a stern warning for English only at the table. They didn't have cards, but if anybody has cards, it's only English that's permissible. The dealer issues a stern warning, whereupon it was revealed that they had in fact been speaking English. So we all got a good laugh, and the dealer blushed. So that was the high point of my day three. All right.
Well, we've got an interview coming up today with Mike Leah, perhaps better known as Go Leafs Go A. And we will, unlike in the past when we've joked about this, we actually are about to go get Mike, digitally go get him, but we actually are recording this just minutes before recording our interview with Mike. But I do want to give a shout out, because I just found out today that two-time guest Andre Coimbra, an all-around good guy, Andre Coimbra, just got engaged to his longtime girlfriend. Proof that you can meet a good woman at a Magic the Gathering tournament, and B, congratulations to Andre.
Yeah, well done. Yeah, it's congratulations. Be happy. I'm sure you will be. And excellent.
So, Mike, you are joining us. Well, I don't know. You're back in Canada now?
Yeah, I took the red eye home from Vegas on Tuesday night, so got back home here Wednesday morning.
Because I kind of ran into you via Leo Wolpert, who's been one of the he's been a frequent guest on our show. And I didn't even realize, but you and I had played together in the 2007 WSOP, which you reminded me of.
Right.
But we ran into each other in the dinner break of the Venetian 5K, and I meant to look up, but I forgot. How did you end up doing in that?
I busted on the third hand of day three. Luckily for me, the bubble burst on the second hand of day three.
Well, that probably wasn't entirely a coincidence.
No. Well, it was a hand that I would have bubbled with for sure. So okay. Just lucky it happened when it did. But yeah, I went into day three with like 18 bigs. Just three bet shoved ace jack on Ami's table chip lead open from the cutoff. So it's pretty standard hand. So it paid 45 spots. I got 45th. So
better than 46, right?
Exactly.
So you're not a Boycott the Venetian guy?
No, to be honest, I really haven't followed the whole situation enough. If I was more educated in it, maybe, you know, I might take a stand one way or the other. But, I didn't play any event anywhere other than the Rio all summer. But when I busted the WSOP main event, me and my backers just kind of looked at the schedule around town and picked a few events that we thought would be good. So Venetian had a couple good ones. And luckily for me, I played the 1100, which I ended up chopping for like 140K, and then played the 5K and min cashed. So it was a decent end to the summer, which, you know, didn't go as well as I would have liked. So
nothing other, no other real significant scores during the series?
No, I had a few good chances in bracelet events. I got in the $1,500 triple draw deuce. I was the chip leader with 12 left and finished 11th. And then in the $2,500 OE event, Omaha 8 or better and stud 8 or better, I was chip leader with 10 left and finished 7th. So I had a couple good chances in those events, but wasn't able to close them off. A couple other caches, a couple other decent stacks. Made it to day three of the 50K, but wasn't able to cash that or any of the 10K mixed events. So I went through a lot of money in those events.
Well, I'm disappointed for you, but there's a bit of me that feels better about this because I saw on Skype too late that you were selling pieces of yourself at face. So I was a little disappointed initially that I didn't get in on that. So there is some small part of me that is glad I didn't miss out on a great opportunity here. Or I guess I did miss out on a great opportunity, but it didn't pan out this time.
Right. And we all have those spots where, you know, we could have done something different in terms of buying pieces, and then you sort of end up sort of anti-sweating some friends or different people because of it. I bought a lot of pieces of main event action and ended up having Devo finish 25th. So I had a pretty exciting sweat right till the end that didn't quite work out, but for him or for me, but it was still all right.
And I'm glad you mentioned some of the other tournaments that you played in the series, because this was something that I wanted to ask you about. I mean, clearly you're a guy who's playing more than just No Limit, but you did get your start in No Limit, right?
Yeah, just started, you know, while I was still working full time, just started fooling around with No Limit Hold'em. I had never played poker like at all in my life at all, so it was a brand new thing. And so
and this is like 10 years ago or something?
Like 2005.
Okay.
Yeah, so about 9 years ago was when I just sort of started playing recreationally with a few friends and then fooling around, a bit online. So I didn't really know any of the other games existed. So definitely started with No Limit Hold'em and then, you know, eventually started fooling around the other games.
What was your job back when you had one?
I had a 16-year career with the same company. So right out of high school, I took some time off before I was going to go to university. And I started working for a sales company and just, you know, started making some really good money right away. So 1 year off of school, ended up becoming two and then three and so on. And worked my way up into a management position and expanded the company right across Canada eventually got settled here in Ontario. And once I sort of, you know, instead of, you know, I lived in hotels for about 10 years while I was growing the company. Bought a house in Ontario, got settled, and which gave me kind of a lot more spare time in the evenings. And that's when I started, you know, playing, quite a bit more poker and had my first sort of success in early 2006, I guess, when I final tabled the Sunday Million the first time I played it after satellating in. And that sort of got me started.
So you actually, I mean, this is kind of the opposite of what a lot of people did. It sounds like you actually settled down and became less nomadic as you started playing poker. Once you transitioned to poker as a career, you were actually spending less time traveling around than you had for your previous job.
Yeah, for sure. different than most. And, you know, also different than most is I started playing basically high stakes like right away and learned how to play the game from playing high stakes poker as opposed to kind of working my way up. So I had some instant success. As I said, I final tabled the Sunday Million the first time. That was on the Sunday. And then I think I got fourth place in like the nightly 162 on Stars on a Wednesday night. No, that would have been a 320. So it must have been Tuesday or Thursday. And then on the Saturday, 320, I ended up getting heads up with Action Jeff and finished second in the Saturday 320. So that was all sort of my first week of playing high school poker. And it was interesting because how I just ran into you for the, you know, at the Venetian 5K, I also ran into Action Jeff for the first time in forever. And it was neat because as we were talking about on dinner for there for a little bit is that he, I got disconnected from the internet and he just waited for me for about a half hour, even though I was a completely unknown person. And we were playing for, I don't know, maybe like 15K or something like that. And he ended up crushing me heads up anyway, but it was kind of interesting. That always sticks with me. So,
yeah, I think that's an impressive show of character.
Yeah, for sure. He had all the money in the world probably back then, but but still, it's still not something everyone would do for sure. But from that point, I ended up winning a satellite to the WSOP main event, and went down and played that for the first time, which was 2006. And then I guess when I played with you was the second time I went down and played the main event. And I think we played on, it's probably like day three or four, right? I know I busted just before the money. So it was,
I was going to say two or three. And I think the money was day three that year.
Okay. So it would have been day three then. Cause I know I busted from that table pretty close to the money, like not on the bubble, but you know, to the point where I was thinking about it, I think.
What gave you, for lack of a better word, the balls to just dive right into the higher stakes tournaments? Not a lot of money for you at the time?
Exactly. I had a really good job. The only reason I wasn't, you know, playing for any money before was, you know, I didn't really know how to play poker, and I, you know, didn't want to just give money away, and so I was just kind of playing around for fun. But once I, you know, won some money in it, then, you know, I just kind of used that money to bankroll me, and I wasn't that worried if I had lost that money because I had a really good solid career and a good income that way. I ended up giving all the money back that I won in poker for sure over the next year because I, you know, I didn't really know what I was doing and I was playing the highest stakes. But yeah, that's basically it. Just like compared to my job income and everything, it wasn't really a lot of money. And I liked, you know, once I won $20,000 in the tournament, I, you know, playing for a first prize of, you know, $500 or anything didn't exactly get my my excitement going. So I just, you know, jumped into the tournaments where I could win some money that gave me adrenaline rush, I guess. And once I ended up losing all the money back, is when I think I, you know, started getting focused at getting better at the game, because if I was going to keep playing it, I didn't want to, you know, lose money at it. So that's kind of when my natural competition sort of set in and help me get better at the game, because I really don't like losing at anything I do. So,
yeah, I was going to, when you said anything you do, I imagine that people with good sales backgrounds would have a lot of tools they could use in poker. Do you think you used a lot of that background?
Yeah, I think like sales was sort of like the second part of my, I guess like the first part of my upbringing was sports. I was really competitive at hockey, and then wrestling was my best sport. I traveled around a lot and won some state championships and you know, provincial championships in Canada, and went to the national championships a few times, and I had scholarships, you know, basically wherever I wanted to go to school, but ended up putting that off. So that was kind of my first sort of you know, I guess training in terms of being competitive and you know, trying to be the best at what I did. From that, it definitely went into sales. I won Salesperson of the Year for my company, I think like 5 or 6 years in a row, and was a really good trainer and you know, kind of, you know, worked my way through the company that way. So, you know, sales and management and then poker was kind of the next part in terms of, you know, competing against others and then trying to be the best that you know, the best that there is, really. That's always been my drive in poker, is to be the best player. It sounds silly to some to say, but you know, I want to be the best poker player in the world, and so I want to, I just keep striving towards that. Whether it was sales or whether it was sports before that, that's kind of just my personality. My brothers and sisters and my dad can tell you any board game or anything we ever play around the house. I made it miserable to play with because I always wanted to win. So, and I always, rubbed it in when I did. So
sometimes becoming really transcendently great at poker, that's a goal that's at odds with winning the most money sometimes, because right. You don't play as much, maybe you study harder, maybe you study exotic things that are only going to get you a little bit of an edge or are going to help you beat sort of top 1% players, but it's important if you want to be the very, very best. Is that a tension you've had to deal with? Is that something you have to talk to your backers about or something?
Similar but not exactly that way. I really only play events that I want to play that have meaning. So, I don't grind at all online. I only play, like FTOPS events or WCOOP events or, the Sunday Million events that kind of, have significance and that I want to play. And then, chasing, bracelets and WSOP events and trying to win Player of the Year and things like that. So it definitely does have some impact on my schedule. But usually the events that I'm playing are in, as a staking point of view, are good value events. I'm not really necessarily wanting to, butt egos in a lot of the, high buy-in events that aren't a lot of, good value, other than, maybe some of the bracelet events and some of those higher buy-ins, like obviously like the 50K Players Championship or some of those 10K mixed events maybe don't have the most value, but they're events that are important to me.
What was the impetus for branching out beyond No Limit? Was that part of the like wanting to be able to call yourself the best poker player mentality?
Not really at the time. It was just, there were, FTOPS events going on, and I guess kind of like, if I wanted to win an FTOPS leaderboard or WCOOP leaderboard, it would have been hard to do without playing all the games. So it started from there. And then WSOP events, just kind of, sort of not really fooling around, but just sort of getting my feet wet in games that I had never played before. So I would enter the smaller buy-in, WCOOP or FTOPS events, and eventually the smaller buy-ins at WSOP, the 1500 mixed games. And for me personally, the best way for me to learn is just from my own mistakes and from my own play. I'm not really great at learning from others, and that's, way back to sales and school and sports and everything else. I'm not very coachable just because I'm very kind of stubborn, and I trust myself more than I trust other people. So that's just, I think it's important to know how you learn, no matter whether it's, golf or tennis or school or poker or anything else, you're probably going to learn in a similar style to how you've learned before. So for me, it was just getting in and playing the events and, and again, just not wanting to suck and wanting to win. So, working harder at them and trying to be as good as I can. I learned how to play Badoogie because I won the Badoogie WCOOP. So the best way to learn that game was to play it for, 10 hours in a row and get to play as many hands as possible in a, atmosphere where I cared how I did, as opposed to, sitting in a 1 cent, 2 cent cash game where you don't really care. Like it's not a good way for me to learn, but, some other people learn better that way.
Poker seems like a tough thing to learn from your mistakes, because it seemed like if you're not already familiar with the game or you're not getting some kind of outside perspective, like how would you know that you made a mistake?
Right. Obviously you need to have an understanding of the game, obviously the rules, and the good thing about poker, I think, is once you know how to play one game, it's a lot easier to learn another form. So I think tried to learn how to play stud and I'd never played anything before, just jumping into a stud tournament probably wouldn't work that well. But if I already know what the best hands are from playing Hold'em and then just, kind of adapting them to stud, I think it worked all right that way. And I think, if someone wants to introduce me to a new poker game now that I've never played before, it's going to be similar to some other variation as you go farther and farther, I guess.
So with a game like Badoogie, that's an interesting case study in being an autodidact, right? Because I remember playing it for a while, then after a while, there are all these plays that I never thought to make I only got from learning, breaking Badoogies, value betting incomplete hands. I mean, I guess some of these are things that occurred to me.
I'd played a lot of Deuce to Seven triple draw before I played Badoogie. So I'm just going from one to the other, as long as you understand, what hand wins. The game plays pretty much the same. You can, bluff or snow in some similar ways. But then, of course, the exact, principles of, what hands the value bet and when exactly you should be bluffing. But more importantly, I think when you're starting out is understanding when other people might be bluffing. That's almost more important than knowing how to do it yourself. You can play pretty straightforward as long as you understand what other people might be doing. Yeah. And similar to, No Limit Hold'em, you don't really need to bluff that much. You don't have to run a big bluff, but it's important to understand that, other people, can be and will be doing it. And if you can pick those off, then that'll get you through a lot.
Yeah. So this is interesting because so you're talking about like the mechanics of the game when you say that they play pretty similarly, right? Because right. Yeah, like, so just because it's harder to improve in Badoogie, that changes a lot. And you get a lot of dealt pat hands that really can't break in Badoogie even more. So that changes everything too. So, I imagine you must be a quick learner because all took me forever.
I obviously ran good in that one W coup and things worked out well. I really didn't know how to play the game that great by the end of the tournament, but I'd played that many more hands than I had before, so it definitely gave me a great sort of introduction and sample size of playing like meaningful hands of Badoogie and picking off a lot of snows and bluffs and things like that.
Yeah.
And then basically from there I adapted it. I played in a lot of high stakes cash games over the last couple of years traveling around, so Badoogie is played in a lot of those mixes, so I definitely just had to be good at the game, otherwise I would have lost a lot of money in during those hands of the mix. So that forces me to really just focus on what those guys are doing and getting good at the game and figuring out when good times are to bluff and whether it's me executing myself or trying to pick off when other people are doing it and figuring out when to break a Badoogie, when to stick with it, when to fold when someone raises you. Like those are all really interesting parts of a hand where you're basically, okay, if I call this check raise on the first draw when I have a pat Badoogie and stick with it, I'm basically stuck with it for, for three more big bets or whatever it's going to end up being. So there's a lot of interesting decisions. Some are similar to Deuce of Seven, some are pretty unique.
Yeah, but you're right that having just a poker background and knowing the mechanics of the game, and I love what you said about even before you want to add a play to your repertoire, like being sensitized to it in other people, I think that's a very sort of observant thing to say, and I think it's something that people conflate a lot. Is that you don't have to be ready to run the big triple barrel bluff, but you should have a sense of what's going through somebody else's head when they're making that decision. I think, right. Yeah, I think all that is right. I think all that is right.
And I think that's kind of what really helped me in my No Limit Hold'em game as I went from online poker to live poker and back and forth in between is I'm kind of a bit of a rare breed in that I started playing poker as at the same time as most of the online geniuses of the last 5 years, and I started playing online with a lot of them, so I sort of have that background. But then I have maybe a lot longer sort of life experience and background, and traveled around and played a lot of live poker in 2007, 2008, 2009. So I kind of have the crossbreed of sort of the online background with a lot of live poker experience as well. So I kind of have sort of the best of both worlds in terms of my upbringing, I think, in the game.
What about just life experience in general? Because just doing some math, it seems like you were probably about 10 years older than the average online genius who started playing in 2005.
I think more than that, but
I was being generous, Mike.
I turned 40 in October, so I think most of them were, you know, starting out, I guess, like the summer in college, some were still in high school, so the various ages, but probably most were, you know, 18, 19 back after the poker boom. So
I mean, you mentioned Action Jeff, he was probably like 16 when he beat you heads up.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, there were some of them as well.
I mean, I guess there are ways in which it helped you and ways in which it didn't. Are there any that you were like conscious of?
No, I think like I definitely was able to, you know, understand and compete with the aggression that some of the young kids had, because I'm, you know, pretty aggressive and competitive by nature. So I can spew with the best of them, but I think I'm also, you know, able to switch gears and knit it up as well, just understanding and, you know, certain situations when it's proper to do both. But, you know, whether that's life experience or just basically understanding the game of being able to have different gears and being able to adjust to the situation, I think is probably the most important thing in adjusting to different tournaments, whether it's live or online or turbo or deep stack, or, you know, just kind of being able to adjust to your surroundings.
I guess having some income outside of poker, or substantial income outside of poker, makes it a little easier for you to do what you did, which is just kind of diving into some of the toughest games that were going at that time and learning by experience, where you know, someone, and I know some of the like internet wizards maybe did have access to a lot of money also, but I think there were a fair number of people like myself who, even if we, you know, could delude ourselves into thinking that we'd be competitive at that level, just didn't have the money to say like, oh, well, if I lose this, it'll be no big deal. And so that certainly slows your learning curve.
Right. But I think it could also be a positive thing, right? If you know, if you worked your way up through low stakes and mid stakes and worked your way and grinded your way to high stakes, you probably learned the game, you know, all the way, the right way, you know, kind of give you all the fundamentals. I sort of had to go backwards and learn the learn the fundamentals after playing high stakes, which was probably more expensive, but it just, you know, just kind of the way it went for me. But 2006, I had a lot of success and, you know, had some big scores and then sort of lost all the money back. And 2007 was sort of the year. I was still working full time, but I was playing probably 2 or 3 evenings a week and all weekend long. And that's sort of where I really learned, you know, I think sort of the skills to play poker profitably online anyway, and then started traveling a little bit. And then September 2008 is when I took a full-time leave from my job to play full-time.
Was that a hard decision to make?
It was. You know, I had a very good job that I worked for at a long time and kind of worked myself into a position where I finally got to where I wanted to be. So it's kind of, I had some regret that I didn't discover poker about 10 years sooner, or I guess I'm definitely happy I found it, and I have no regrets that I left my job. It was kind of weird timing that I'd finally gotten to where I wanted to be in my career, and then I discovered poker. But I knew I had to choose one or the other at that time, because my work was definitely getting in the way of my poker goals and what I wanted to do, and obviously poker was starting to get in the way of my job performance and what I needed to do at my job. So I took a temporary leave in the summer of 08 so I can go grind the World Series and sort of test out my skills, I guess, on sort of a full-time basis. The summer didn't go very well at all, but I ended up not really banking, but I finished, I think, fourth in the Caesars main event at the end of the World Series in 08. So I won about, I think, like 74K or something like that. And I was being staked for that. I had ended up sort of running into some guys near the end of the summer after I went through the money that I had sort of budgeted and sort of made a short-term staking agreement with them. So I ended up, you know, hitting something pretty decent for them and getting to know them. And they offered me a full-time staking deal at the end of the summer, which gave me the sort of security and confidence to leave my job, knowing that I wouldn't be risking my own money that I had saved away. So it was kind of a risk-free way to do it, where I still had financial security in my house and things, where if things didn't go well, I'd be okay, but someone else putting up the money for me to sort of dive in and play poker full-time.
Mm-hmm. And you didn't have a family that was dependent on you for income?
That was the other thing that made it a lot easier. I had no wife, no kids, just a couple dogs. And so other than finding a dog sitter when I traveled, that was really the only thing I needed to do. So, and I ended up having a lot of success right away with them at the end of 2008 and then through the beginning of 2009, where I was basically traveling full time. And I was in the running for all the Player of the Year races, halfway through 2009. And then I started trying to run a Bax and Sheets style backing operation myself. The latter half of 2009, but that was a learning experience.
What kind of experience do you feel like you lacked to do that?
Just enough. I had a lot of business and financial kind of management experience, which I thought was kind of good enough, and I thought I had enough poker experience, but I just didn't understand enough of the game. And I guess in terms of variance, like I'd always done so well and starting off everything I did, I thought it would be a bit easier than I guess I thought it was easier than maybe it was realistically for most people. I just always I started with three horses and won an F top, so I added three more, and then won a W coupe, so I added three more, and I just started trying to grow a bit too big without understanding, if no one wins something for a month, how much it would cost. So just not having enough staking and backing experience in poker was my downfall.
I thought you were going to say the problem was like not having experience dealing with, either getting money from people who try to steal from you, or dealing with people who, like, even if they're good when they're playing at their best, like getting them into a good mindset, especially if they're in makeup. Yeah. Or that's kind of how I thought you were going to answer that question.
Those are the things that I think I did better than most, and that I still think I, do better than most staking or operations. Number one, a good thing and a bad thing is I picked a lot of friends and people that I knew well, so I could trust them with money, and that, I can trust that, I wanted them to do well personally and they wanted to do well for me personally. So that was all good, but maybe they weren't, they didn't have the skill required, or they weren't, the best players available. I ran my staking operation sort of like a sales team or a sports team. I tried to make it a team atmosphere to give them the support. And even if they were 40K in makeup and they were playing a tournament where first place was 20,000, I kind of have different agreements with different players. Like, if you win 10K, sure, it doesn't cover your red, but I'll give you 10 or 20% of that. So that you, can put some money in your pocket, and then, just put the rest back towards your red and do some different things like that, that I think are important to keep players motivated when they're building big red numbers and things like that. Mm-hmm. That some staking operations do and some don't. And I think having a unique approach with each person is important, just as it is in whether it's sales management or poker management or anything else.
So you use the present tense. The experience didn't sour you on it? Like, this is something you keep on doing maybe on a smaller scale today?
Yeah, for sure. I've definitely I've done different a lot of different things over the years. I truly believe that every player should be staked, because if you have money, you can invest it other ways and keep your security while playing poker. But if you have extra money, I really do think that staking and backing, whether it's buying pieces or having full-time horses, is profitable if you do it the correct way. So I try to invest as much as I can, maybe a little bit smarter than I did before in poker, and then I also you know, have been staked for most of my poker career on and off in different ways. So I'm definitely on both sides of it quite often.
So I think we have some listeners who consider themselves good enough at poker to get staked and would be interested in that, but don't really know how to go about doing it. Like, right. Let's say somebody came for a traditional job interview with you. Besides demonstrating poker skill to you and besides demonstrating honesty to you, what are some specific skills that a horse has that you look for?
I would look personally for, you mentioned the two most important, of course, having a player that's skilled. It's obviously a lot easier to have that than to try and coach that. And my own playing takes up so much of my time that, you know, coaching or working with players isn't, you know, something that I really want to do if I don't have to. So, skill and being trustworthy. Unfortunately in the poker world, you know, who you know, and, that's such a huge part of getting staked and finding that, because if someone doesn't trust you or know you, they're going to be much more reluctant to, you know, to give you a whole bunch of money to, you know, to go play for them. So connections, you know, getting into sort of a poker community and having, you know, friends that you talk and play poker with and eventually get to know more and more players is an important thing. So, you know, connections, branching out, you know, being part of things like 2+2 is a great way if you don't have a, you know, a bunch of friends to sort of, you know, make poker acquaintances and be part of the forums and you get to know a lot of people that way. Whether it's, you know, 2+2 or even like some of the training sites, you know, IV or TPE, you can become part of forums and a community that way and get to know a lot of people and get people to sort of see how you understand the game and talk about hands and things like that.
Was that anything where you felt like your age made a difference? Like that it was harder to connect with some of the other people who were among the best players or the people that you wanted to learn from?
Not really. I've always kind of, you know, had a pretty good circle of poker friends from different areas. I guess the guys that I met that summer were probably a bit closer to my age, kind of, you know, sort of live grinders that had been, you know, sort of traveling the circuit for a bit longer. So that was sort of my first sort of a poker circle of guys that I, you know, talked hands with and strategy with and sort of the first people that I, you know, sort of trusted to actually listen to their opinion as opposed to just my own. And it's helped me a lot in terms of learning the game of, you know, being able to, you know, listen to how other people think through hands. And that's helped me, especially learning different mixed games. You know, having people that I trust to, you know, to hear what they would have done in a hand. And I might not believe them the first time they say it, and I might still think my way is better, but eventually then I sometimes I'm able to digest what they're saying. But I think I have like some of the young guys are that I'm friendly with. Yeah, I don't necessarily need to go out and hang out and drink with them and stuff like that and party with them to, you know, to be able to sort of talk poker with them.
And you've mentioned you know, being a little reluctant to take in other people's input on poker hands. Do you do like your own work with especially like when you're learning a new game with equity calculators and that sort of stuff?
Not so much. There's a lot of times where I'll play a hand a certain way and then kind of, you know, go back after my session and think about, well, was that correct or was it not? And that's maybe when I'll look at a, you know, calculator to see exactly where, you know, what was the more correct path to do. You know, when I'm playing a tournament or something, it's more just about, you know, what seems right at the time. And then I guess going back and learning afterwards. I'm probably, you know, to be honest, a bit lazy in terms of preparation. I'm much better at evaluating after. And as I said, learning from my mistakes or not only it's like when I say learning from my mistakes or learning from experience, it's also learning from what I see other people do. Whether it's during an online tournament, I'll see someone play a hand weird and I'll look back at it and I can learn just as much from that hand as from my own, or in a live setting, you know, when you see someone make a mistake or make a play a certain way, or also sometimes when you see someone make a really amazing play that you wouldn't have thought of making. You can learn things that way as well. You know, you see someone, for example, use a, you know, a deuce to seven hand where, you know, someone's pad and you make like a two-way hand and you raise on the second draw to try and get them to break, you know, or fold, or if they call, well, then you can break your hand. Like there's things that you pick up that you might not have thought of on your own. And I think I'm just good at learning that way from just seeing things happen and then kind of, you know, trying to develop the skill from there. And of course, you know, whether, you know, equity or things like that, trying to figure out what was the best play at the time or see with some of those games, you know, like in Deuce to Seven, it's more feel, or in those draw games, it's not always in a math thing when you're maybe trying to get someone to fold a rough pad hand or things like that. So it's just, I guess, a bit of feel or figuring out what they have and what they're potentially going to do.
It seems like it would be tricky to develop that feel across a lot of different games.
I don't know. I have to kind of go individually. Like they're all very different. You know, stud eight games. You know, like there's moments in a hand where someone's often going to either fold on that street or go to the end. But there's not sort of that pressure that you can maybe put on in like a draw game where you put in that check raise on the second draw. So the stud games are a bit different in that. It's just kind of one bet at a time, and there's not, you know, ever really that big decision where someone all of a sudden has a pat hand or doesn't have a pat hand. So it's a bit different than the draw games. I don't know, stud is a bit different because of the antes and the dead money. So there's, you know, a lot of aggression and a lot of success in aggression in trying to, you know, win hands without a necessary, you know, with an actual hand, when you can just represent something with your up cards. And I think if you look at the WSOP stud results of the last couple of years, you saw like George Danzer who did it this year and Matthew Ashton who did it last year and you know, winning or going deep in all the stud events. And, you know, they're definitely two of the most aggressive stud players you'll ever play with. So, you know, there's different skills that can help you in different games and in a tournament setting anyway.
Do you find there's a big difference in the way you approach those games in tournaments versus in cash games?
Yes, because in cash games, in limit games, almost no one is going to make a big fold because it's only one bet. It's, you know, right. you can't put that much pressure on them. But in a tournament setting, when people start getting short and you know the bets start getting bigger, you can definitely put a lot more pressure on them in a tournament setting than you can in a cash game setting.
Interesting. That makes sense.
I mean, another thing that happens in tournaments is that you're playing with three big blind effective stacks, like not so not which happens fairly frequently, and that just messes everything up. So hands you would never think of playing for a single raise, you do because the reverse implied odds aren't there because the money isn't there. So, but then, you know, maybe somebody else is going to raise me. I mean, Mike knows this stuff much better than I do, I think, but that's a big adjustment I find myself making.
Yeah, for sure. All those unique situations that just don't happen in a cash game very often, which is why, you know, having like just a tournament background helps you a lot when you're learning those other games and when you're playing those other games in tournaments. I think like a really good tournament player with some knowledge of stud is probably going to be better in a stud tournament than someone that's been playing stud cash for 20 years but has never played a tournament.
Do you think ultimately the tournament considerations are kind of more important than the stud specific expertise?
Yes, for sure.
So I guess that answers the next question I was going to ask you, which was, I mean, because you mentioned before, if I understood you correctly, that you kind of chose tournaments based either on them being like a significant tournament, you know, a WCUP, F-Tops, part of a big series or something, or bracelet hunting.
Right.
Is it that you feel like you have an edge in those bracelet events because of your tournament knowledge, or is it that you really want a bracelet?
Both, I think. I like my edge definitely gotten better over the last couple years. I think you know, this, what year is this, 2014? I'd say from, like, I probably started dabbling in maybe like 2011, 2012. I probably played most of the 1500 mix games. I was probably like 100% better from 2013 to 2012, and maybe another, you know, 50% better this year from last year, just in terms of my skill and knowledge and experience in playing those mixed games. But I had good results, you know, now and then over the last few years. Like, you know, I won a Raz F-Tops, I think, geez, maybe like 2 years ago when I, you know, which one was that? I'm trying to think which one is which. But anyways, like I've had good results in mixed game events when I really wasn't near as skilled in the games as I am now, just because, you know, you can kind of just tournament strategy and aggression and things that I did that helped me win tournaments when I wasn't necessarily that great at the games. But when you put them both together now, you know, having tournament experience, but also all the hands that I've played in the mixed games over the last few years, you know, I think I'm at the point now where, you know, I have the skill in the games plus the, you know, the tournament background and strategy that can, you know, give me maximum edge in the mixed game events.
What's the desire for a bracelet?
Just personal goal. You know, I just, it's something that I've definitely set as the number one goal in my life and something I want to achieve, just because I've, you know, I've put in so much time and effort of trying to get it done. You know, the longer it takes to do it, it means that much more. It's like, it, you know, I'm never going to wear it. It's, you know, it's just something that I want to achieve, I guess, the legacy or the, you know, the amount of time that I've put into my poker career of trying to achieve that goal. Just, it's become very important and basically a necessity of something I want to achieve over the last couple of years. So
you do think of that as kind of a necessary, like, feather in your cap to be a really top-notch poker player, or to be recognized as such.
Right, but the thing is, like, once I get the first one, it's not going to change, because then, right. then I'm going to want number two as bad as I want number one right now. I don't know, it's just sort of a, you know, it's like I've, you know, it's something that, you know, measuring success, like, for me, I set my poker goals, you know, like, I want to, you know, do good in certain events and series and things like that. And if I do that, I know the money sort of takes care of itself. I'm not good at motivating myself by money, which is why I'm not a really good cash game player. I'm just not good at trying to, like, make a living or make profit. I want to try and win things. And I know if I win something, then, you know, obviously money's a byproduct of that. It's just the way that I motivate myself and sort of drive myself to play, because I want to, you know, achieve different things, and whether it's, you know, bracelet hunting or, you know, F-tops leaderboard stuff, or it's the way that works best to, you know, to motivate myself and to make something worth playing for me, so that I play it to my best. Otherwise, you know, if it's something I don't care about, then I'm probably not going to play very well.
Well, I mean, I know that you don't need me to tell you this, but, like, obviously the player who gets the bracelet or who wins the tournament, like, it's obviously not proof that was the best player in the field, and right. You're obviously not just going to be able to count bracelets and decide, like, this was the best, you know, this is the best player because he has the most bracelets.
Right. No, I got, you know, yeah. Like, last year I got three-handed with Mike Matisau and Matthew Ashton in the 5K stud 8 event, and Matisau won. And nothing against Mike. I think he's an awesome person and he's great for the game of poker and he's had some great success. But I think me and Matthew Ashton would both, you know, honestly in their mind would tell you that they think they're, you know, a better tournament player than Mike.
Right? Yeah, I think if you all had even chips, not a lot of people would be betting on Mike there at even odds.
Well, some people would. It's different communities of different
yeah, that's true. That's
different,
true.
Different perceptions.
I guess what I'm wondering, though, I mean, is there not some, like, cognitive dissonance for you to, on the one hand, say, like, I'm really motivated to get this, and on the other hand to say, but I recognize that it's not really that meaningful?
Nope.
He wants it. He wants it. It's a goal. It's a thing that he wants.
it's very meaningful for me, and something that's meaningful to me. It doesn't really matter if it's meaningful to other people or not. It's just, you know, something that I want to achieve. And like it, you know, winning poker tournaments and stuff like that. What, you know, it puts, you know, the meaning on it. Like, I understand not always the best player is going to win the tournament, but the person that does win the tournament, you know, did something or did enough things right to win that tournament, and you know, they win. They get the good feeling at the end where they didn't lose their last hand and feel miserable. Yeah. It's just, you know, not very often you get the, you know, not bust from a tournament, right?
Yeah.
So it's a good your feeling. Own bounty. Yeah. Exactly. It doesn't happen all that often, so when it does, you know, it's a cool thing.
So is poker it for you for the foreseeable future?
Definitely. You know, I have, you know, other interests and hobbies, but you know, a lot of them are sort of byproducts or sort of part of poker anyway. I can't see myself ever, you know, leaving the poker world. I may play more or less some years or some months than others, but it's definitely my main interest and main focus, and it's, you know, how I make my income. So and obviously I need to play for that reason, but I also really just enjoy the game, and I have so many goals that I want to achieve that I haven't achieved yet. So I'm definitely going to be striving towards those and keep playing and trying to, you know, get better and better and accomplish more things.
It sounds like you're still enjoying it. There hasn't been a significant burnout for you.
No, I think everyone sort of gets burnt out in different times. And there's definitely some times where I've kind of maybe forgotten, you know, sort of how lucky I am, but, you know, to be able to play a game for a living, or, you know, same things like, you know, you hear athletes saying and stuff like that, where, you know, they get to play a game for, you know, instead of working, and they get to make money from it. Poker's a little bit different because it's not guaranteed money and you can lose money as well, but that's a difference as opposed to an athlete's salary. But you know, whenever I, you know, get together for dinner with friends outside of poker or my family, and, you know, they're all infatuated by what I do and think that I'm, you know, the luckiest person in the world because I can sleep till 2 in the afternoon if I feel like it, and can make, you know, a year's salary in one tournament and things like that. It's pretty unique, and sometimes you just need, you know, to balance and get away from it sometimes and take enough of a break, because, you know, you can always play poker. There's always another series or always another tournament, especially me living in Canada where I can play online. You know, there's always something you can be playing. So for me, I think just, you know, balancing and taking enough time off and having vacation and things like that are important to me still, you know, keeping the joy of what I do and not taking it for granted or not getting burnt out or tired or sick of it. But the game itself, I love. It's just sometimes, just like anything, if you do it too much, you maybe get a little bit bored or sick of it. But
aside from dinner with family, what are the kind of things that you're doing to take a break?
Well, these next couple of weeks are just going to be some downtime, heading out to the lake and lying on the beach and relaxing and, you know, spending time with family and nieces and nephews and my dogs and chilling out, just kind of being lazy for a little while. But, you know, going to Blue Jays games and sports games and getting out and getting to the gym and getting exercise and things like that are going to be the rest of my summer, trying to, you know, get back in shape and recover from the 49 days in a row of poker that I played.
You like the Blue Jays' chances this year?
I did a lot more a couple weeks ago. It's you know, I was sitting there in the World Series and, you know, thinking about coming home and getting to watch them in like a pennant race, but then kind of everything went south for a couple weeks, so I'm a little bit more nervous about it. But we'll get out to some games and hopefully they can get healthy and turn it around.
Very possible. And yeah. Very important question, what kind of dogs?
I have a French Bulldog and a Boston Terrier.
Excellent.
They're great dogs. My Boston, you know, I was excited to get home and see him. He has a tumor, so they weren't sure he's going to make it through the summer, but he's still doing all right. So spending some time with him before he has to go is a high priority for me. So
yeah, very good. And what do you do with them when you're in Las Vegas? You have
One of my best friends has lived in my house for probably about 5 years. I got a, you know, nice house with a furnished basement, so he kind of has that as his room. And so when I'm away, I just have a live-in dog sitter, house sitter. So
very good.
So they're well looked after. So.
Well, I think we've kept you for a while. Andrew, do you have more questions? Can we thank Mike?
Yeah, unless there's anything you feel like we've left out, Mike.
No, other than, there's Ivy League, which is an Ivy Poker, which is, slowly coming along. The videos are getting better, and hopefully before too long in the U.S. and elsewhere, we'll have real money gaming there as well. So it's something to what we're working towards.
So it is, I'm sorry, I don't know a whole lot about it. I kind of thought it was just a training site, but it is hosting poker games as well.
Well, we have Ivy Poker, which is the Facebook app, so you can play with the pros for free there. And then Ivy League is the training site, and Real Money Gaming will hopefully before too long be launched as well. So,
and just to be totally clear, you're making training videos, yes?
Yeah, I've done a few with Ivy League, and hopefully we'll be doing more now that I have some downtime. But there are some training videos up there from me and from the other pros.
Excellent. So if you're a big Mike fan, you can check them out there. Anything else that our listeners should know about you?
They can follow me on Twitter at GoLeafsGoA, and hopefully we'll have some good stuff and some bracelet hunting, and we got WSOP APAC coming up in October, and F-Tops before that in August. So we'll be trying to win F-Tops jersey number 5, I think, is my next immediate goal.
Yeah, you're like a co-record holder on those, right?
Yeah, I got to get rid of UV. I got to pass him.
Well, good luck with that.
All right, thanks, guys.
Thanks so much. It's been a pleasure. I appreciate it.
The fair passage of a bill, and who will sign us in too long? I know you won't.